Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with patient and patient advocate, Emily Ulrich. She was a former professor of communication arts and founder of the Nairobi Film Institute. In 2015, she was diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome. She has a history of interstitial cystitis and endometriosis. And on top of that, in 2019, she was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. As a result, she has had to adapt her lifestyle according to her medical issues. And with that, I'd like to welcome Emily. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Emily, tell us a little bit about how you navigate your medical conditions on a day-to-day basis, how the symptoms present, and how you identify various ways to deal with your conditions.
What was the last part? How I identify?
Deal with the conditions.
So it depends on the day, right? So just like everyone else, I have good days and bad days. Unfortunately, I frequently have more bad days. And my symptoms change from day to day, as I think a lot of chronic pain and Ehlers-Danlos patients do. I've always had pelvic pain since I was preteen, and that has always been a big daily struggle, and then monthly struggle. Within that month, it would get worse at certain times, and when I had my period, and now I also have the digestive elements that are involved, that are Ehlers-Danlos related, and I have complex regional pain syndrome in my right knee after getting arthritis or meniscus repair surgery. So that developed, and so day to day, it just depends. I have sometimes head to toe issues, and always I have the right knee pain, and sometimes I'm able to cope and engage and function, and then some days I need to stay home and I don't get out of bed.
For many people who do not have these complex conditions and struggle to understand, for lack of better phrase, struggle to understand what life may be like for you, can you talk a little bit about how you recognize the symptoms? What is the experience, the perception of your conditions, and how do you know this is Ehlers-Danlos, this is endometriosis? How does that perceive in your mind and in your body?
So that's a great question. And I definitely read almost every day medical journals. I read peer-reviewed papers. And I recognized probably preteen that I had something going on pelvic pain-wise that was abnormal. I was having literally would pass out sometimes on my period days. And I was told repeatedly that's normal. It's just normal. Just everybody has pain like that. I knew that wasn't really right because my friends didn't have pain like that. My other family members didn't. But my mom did have pretty bad pain like that at her period. So I thought maybe that was my fate. But after I read a lot and talked to a lot of people, I started questioning my doctors and questioning what I was told and questioning what was happening in my body. And the Ehlers-Danlos situation became clear to me the more I read about Ehlers-Danlos, that I had all of the bite and score criteria, right? The touching, you know, being able to touch your thumb to your arm and put my hands flat on the floor, bending over. I can't remember all of the points of it. I think it's like 12 criteria that you're able to do. I think four or more is categorized as Ehlers-Danlos. And there's more genetic information that goes into the diagnosis as well. But just the more I read, the more I realized, you know, oh, there's definitely more going on here than I'm being told. And what you mentioned, I think it's really important. And that's something that I really wanted to address in this podcast, is the way we are perceived is a big thing. And So what goes on in our heads as a chronic pain patient or intractable pain patient, and the way that people think you should just be able to get over it and get out of the house and come on, you've had weeks or years, and some of us, why can't you get better? Why are you just emotional? Is it in your head? And it's not in our heads. And there is no one who would want to be in this situation. There's no one who would think, I want to free your hide, or this is going to be fun to hang out on the couch all the time, because it's really not fun. And being stuck in the house and sick every day is not anything anyone chooses. And I think that we really have to do a better job of communicating with each other and with our doctors. And doctors have to do a better job of recognizing that these issues do exist. And that's why I'm really glad people like you exist and will start these conversations.
Speaking of conversation, what you had mentioned was the relationship between a patient and a physician and requiring a certain level of understanding. Can you give some examples of where the communication went well and how that affected your course of care, and an example where it did not go well and how that affected your course of care?
Yes. So an example of when it went well is when I finally got to the Children's Hospital genetics lab after years of looking into my Ehlers-Danlos symptoms and trying to find doctors who maybe recognized what was going on there. And the genetics lab asked me all these questions that no other doctor had asked me, that I had become aware that these were the questions that would lead to my diagnosis. So I was very relieved to be asked these specific questions about history. And they took a lot of time, which I think is a big part of why that communication often doesn't happen with patients and their providers, because we are complex patients and it does take a lot of energy and time. And I think often we come across as complainers, and you know, there's so many things in different systems wrong, you know, digestive issues, joint pain. And a lot of times the way our healthcare system is currently, systemic issues like that are kind of, no one wants to deal with them, right? Because you can go to a gastro, but the gastro only knows about that symptom, or you can go to a GIM, or you can go to a dermatologist, but the dermatologist will know about your skin, your digestive issues. So when you have a systemic issue that affects everything, then it becomes a harder struggle and a more complex situation. And an example of when it went bad, I have a lot of those. But the worst thing is just mostly being overlooked, being told, kind of gaslit and told that you're not feeling what you know you're feeling.
Yeah, it's tough. And I'm sorry if you had to go through that. I want to maybe parse through a bit on those negative or unfortunate communication examples, because I think it's important to distill what was clinical and what was non-clinical about those experiences. Oftentimes, patients with complex conditions will be judged off of non-clinical factors, the way they look, the way they speak. How much of those negative experiences, in your mind, were based off of the complexity of your clinical conditions as opposed to non-clinical factors that unfortunately may have put you in a negative situation?
So that's hard to say. I mean, I can't say with precise numbers, but I definitely know that I have been misperceived. I'll give an example. For the first maybe year that I was going through getting disability together and being approved for it, I didn't really understand that I thought I was supposed to tell a doctor that I'm disabled. And so when they would say, "What do you do?" because that's always one of the first questions. I would say I'm disabled. And that is something I quickly learned is not the first thing to tell a lot of doctors, because they are people who focus very much on accomplishing things. And so when you walk in there and say, I'm not working, then oftentimes you're perceived as someone who is not being a part of society, who's not interested in contributing. And then that often reflects on how you're treated and what kind of care you'll receive. So there's that aspect. And then there's also aspects of being a woman, being having pelvic issues, having any sort of anxiety or depression. Those things also get perceived. And whether it's direct, you know, stereotyping or just implicit bias, I don't know what level, but they happen. And I understand that that's the way our society is. So you kind of learn as a patient what the quote unquote right thing to say is to get to where you need to be in those appointments.
Are you able to recognize when it's happening in real time, or do you reflect on it and notice it afterwards?
So I've become very good at quickly editing in my mind, like what I need to do, what I need to say, how to get there, because I'm running a clock in my mind the whole time. Like, we're probably only going to have 15 minutes of conversation. I know I've got to get at least these two or three points out. And sometimes I will correct in real time and redirect. Often I take hours processing on the way home. I'll go over it with my husband. Now he goes to almost every initial appointment with me, because I've realized that for whatever reason, if there's a man there and a man with a job, I'm going to be perceived more seriously and my complaints will be taken more seriously. So his testimony means often just as much, if not more, than mine does.
Can you give an example of where having your husband gave you a certain level of credibility that you may not have gotten otherwise?
Definitely. I was hospitalized multiple times with gallbladder issues, pancreas issues, sphincter of OD dysfunction. And almost every time I was left for hours, days, sometimes in the hospital, crying, screaming in pain. And often nurses, doctors would come and go singing, laughing, just ignoring completely the devastation that was happening right there for me. And if I didn't have someone else there, another family member who could aggressively keep asking, what's going to happen? What's the plan? She needs pain management. Clearly, she has a tolerance because she's been on pain medicine before, and it's not going to kill her. So one of the examples I'll give you is I had been seen by a doctor, and she ordered some pain medication. The nurse decided that it was too high of a level of pain medication. The dose was too high and she wasn't comfortable with it. And she started putting all these different monitors on my head and body for like heart rate and blood pressure. I had a headband on and the pulse ox thing, like some of them were regular things, right? The pulse ox and the blood pressure monitor. But then also she added like a headband and some type of neck monitor, pulse monitor, all of these extra things that seemed ridiculous to me, because I clearly have been on medication for a long time. And it was, this doctor had seen me before and had ordered these medications knowing me and knowing my history. But this nurse had gotten scared by the rhetoric that's happening right now surrounding opioids and was afraid to treat me with the ordered medications. So, and in that scenario, my husband being there really helped too.
Well, I'm glad that you had that resource. That's very fortunate. What are some other instances or tips you may have for those listening that can help them increase their credibility? do providing clinical studies or providing your medical records help? What are some credibility tips that you have for some of the listening audience members?
So one of the biggest things that I think seemed obvious to a lot of people that haven't been in the situations, but for me, I still have to remind myself not to be emotional, not to show how angry or hurt that I am by the situation, because then that becomes the main thing that's happening, my emotions, not the pain or the illness. And so that's something that I try to remind myself and others, to just be calm and not address the emotional or societal things that often plague us when we have been judged and misperceived. And also, I definitely think, as you mentioned, having some credible peer-reviewed journal, some sort of source of information that's not just a Google search, you know, it shows that you have an intelligent, what they call a history taker. Is it not a history taker? I can't think of the word. Her history is and often in a visit, a doctor will say whether or not you're a valid recorder of your own history. I don't know if I'm using the right term, but if you are able to express in medical terms properly what surgeries you've had or what diagnoses, then you come across as more credible than if you were to say, you know, for example, instead of saying I have my gallbladder removed, I would say I had a cholecystectomy. And that shows that I've paid attention, that I know what terminology is, things like that.
Knowing the terminology is big in your mind.
Could you say that again, please?
Knowing the terminology is big. You consider that an important factor in the communication.
Yes, yes. I definitely think that if you have a complex condition, you have to know the medication terminology, the tissue terminology, the history. You need to know your own history, your family history, your genetic history, and any surgeries you've had. You have to know exactly what they did, where you had it, and how long it's been, how you healed. You need to know what medications worked for you and be able to discuss your history in a clear, concise way.
For patients like yourself that have a strong communication background, you are obviously a professor. Communication may come more easily compared to others. For some patients with similarly complex conditions who may lack the natural communication talent that you have, how can they build their communication skills?
Good question. I struggle with that myself, and I was also have done a lot of performance, so I struggle with that because I am used to our societal standard of needing to look pretty all the time and bring out your best when you're in public. And so I have to remind myself even, you know, that this is not always A-plus performance. Like, you just have to get out there and do your best. And the best thing that I can tell people is be honest, be direct, and be concise. There's a lot of, because we're so complicated and there is a lot of history for everyone that has these complex conditions, there's a tendency for us to sort of scroll in our head through all of the things that we've gone through, both emotionally and physically. And I think that people can see you sort of going back through that whole history your mind, and they sort of back up and don't want to get involved in all of that. So I think it's good to pick like three things that I'm going to address in this visit. These are my top three issues I want to address. And have looked into them, done your research at credible websites, medical journals, articles, whatever, and be able to discuss those things and know what your options are and know how you would like to, what you would like to at least have offered for you for treatment and how you'd like to move forward.
Thank you for that. I want to transition and talk about your advocacy, because you're quite vocal in expressing your own personal history, your thoughts on how healthcare as a system has failed many patients with similar conditions. What is your reason for advocacy?
What is what?
What is your reason for advocacy? Why do you do it?
So I did not, I came into advocacy very naturally, because I've always been sort of someone who has a sense of what's injustice, and I've always been someone who, as soon as I see or feel injustice, I'm going to be fighting for what I think is right. And as soon as these health issues started happening with me, I saw that they happen more often to women, that they happen more often to people of color, and that they happen more often to people with disabilities, and that we are also the same ones that the system doesn't have as much knowledge of. And so things like Ehlers-Danlos, for example, is, I think, 80% female. I don't know if that's exactly right, but it's heavily a female disease. So obviously, women aren't the only ones who get Ehlers-Danlos, but I believe the statistic is approximately 80%. So, and also chronic pain in general is heavily a female issue that it does, of course, touch on every person. I mean, every socioeconomic group, every gender, every race. But because I was seeing so much of myself, what was happening, I want to go back a little bit. So I was in the film industry before I became disabled. Usually I was the only female on set. So I got used to identifying in my head sort of what is typical for a situation where there are almost never any women around. And so it became very clear to me from that. And then moving into being in a doctor's office or a hospital, dealing with mostly predominantly men, and having had that mindset of being the only woman or one of two, usually women, I translated to dealing with medical professionals, because they're often male doctors. And I could, because of that, sort of feel when a scenario was being judged on my gender instead of what actually was happening.
Oh, it's well said. In the remaining time, I want to talk about your advocacy in terms of what it has done for you as an individual, because we know the importance of advocacy at a system level and the slow but hopefully steady progress that we're starting to see. But for you as an individual, kind of your own internal feeling, how has advocacy helped you?
It has helped me a lot. I really am always blown away by how much creativity and passion is out there and how much community we've been able to build as people that often don't leave the house for days or sometimes weeks at a time and not feeling well. There is a big community out there that it really makes you realize that you're not alone and that other people feel this too. And so advocacy really helped me to sort of get my confidence back. I've never really been like a shy or oddball-y kind of person as far as personality, but then when I started getting sick, I felt out. I felt outcast. I felt othered, and I didn't like that. And I don't think anybody likes that. But it advocacy sort of helped to bring back my confidence and make me feel like I had a purpose and a community, and all those things are important.
Well said. For those who are listening and may want to reach out to you, learn from your experiences, or just simply glean your advice, what's the best way that they can get a hold of you?
They can reach me through Daily Remedy. They can reach me on Instagram or Twitter, just Emily Ulrich, and they'll be able to find me on any of the social media. I have a TikTok, but I haven't started doing. I ideally would like to do a podcast, and I'm working on that. That's one of the things that I sort of have set a goal for myself to do, and I'm going to try to do that within the next year. I'm still kind of having a conversation with myself around these things about being on camera when I don't feel well, and I'm still trying to get over that. But that's one of the things that I really want to do in the next year is be able to be out there advocating for our community and be on camera even when I don't feel well and let people see what it really is like.
No, that's well said. I would encourage any of you who are listening to follow her on any of the social media platforms, follow her writing and her advocacy. And with that, Emily,
Thank you.
thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.